This edition of Culture with Robert Bound was first broadcast on the 14th of April 2014 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to the 131st edition of Culture with me, Robert Bounds. It's that time of year where we're feeling the burgeoning fecundity and sap risingness of spring. With renewed zeal and a trouser full of good ideas, here's what's happening this week. We'll inspect the leanness and meanness of the global TV industry with a report from a man who survived the parties and pitches on canned La Croisette to tell us what was hot at this year's MIP TV.
It felt very much like a ticking bomb,
right?
And that gives an element of danger, and I just thought that was quite an interesting tick on the sort of game show genre.
We'll also hear from the movers and shakers of Stockholm's art scene. It always seems like something of an underperforming city in terms of brush and paint. Why? We'll assess the struggle of museums and the art market in Scandinavia.
There's not that many people showing kind of the caliber of Richard Prince and Peter Doig and Boetti, Hearst, except for the great institutions. So I guess it's new in the fact that it's a gallery sort of dedicated to bringing that sort of work.
And we'll meet the new generation of Chilean playwrights breathing life back into the nation's theatre scene. Plus, amidst the controversy surrounding this year's Sydney Biennale, we'll ask if it's any good. We'll sit down with Sean Couty to hear about his new album and welcome Man of Isolation, Novo Amor, for this week's Midori House session. That's all coming up here on Culture with me, Robert Bounds, on Monocle 24. So we kick off with our session this week, and today we're choosing intimacy over noise. Novo Amor is the nom de plume of Ali Lacey. Working in isolation, he's created a very fragile sound that tips the hat to acoustic singer-songwriters such as Bon Iver and James Vincent McMorrow, but pared down to its bare essentials. He dropped by Midori House last week to give us a taster of his new EP, Woodgate NY, which is out next week on Norwegian label Brilliance Records. And here he is with So We Drift.
Forgo this ritual of silence. My thoughts collapse me. Undergo your habitual ways of violence. Vibrance is gone with the wind.
The mellow and haunting sounds of Novo Amor, a.k.a. Ali Lacey, with So We Drift. More of those delicate melodies coming up later on in the show. This is Culture on Monocle 24. We're upping the pace now and crossing to the sunny La Croisette Strip, because last week was the TV industry's grandest old leg shaker, its oldest school shindig. Seasoned Culture listeners will know that we like to get the lowdown on MIP TV, essentially a dirty weekend in Cannes, under the auspices of checking out the newest, best and most beautiful new TV formats, markets and deals. And who's this that hoves into view in his Panama and slacks, fresh from the Corniche? Heck, it's Broadcast Magazine's Peter White.
MIP in April is always a little bit quieter than MIPCOM in October. It tends to be a bit more focused around the Europeans and some of the other regions. So there's no Americans, and that was the thing a lot of people were talking about this time. So there was very few Hollywood studios or some of those big American producers that tend to sort of overrule when they're there. So it sort of gave a bit of an opportunity for some of the smaller places to have a crack and get their sort of formats talked about. We often, when we come in here, talk about Israel is the new Holland or Scandinavia is the new Israel. It sort of feels now that that's sort of, there hasn't been a new place. I think someone was trying to tell me Ireland was the new Israel.
In terms of, I mean, with the sort of lack of American presence, as you say, April's different to October at MIP. Presumably that lets other territories shine. Yeah. In terms of sort of France, Germany, Holland, these people that presumably are sort of solid, mm-hmm. especially Holland always seems to fight above its weight in TV formats and TV production. Are France still kind of on your radar? It always seems to be a huge country that doesn't seem to sort of fighting its own weight.
You're right. There's an element of, because it's quite solid, it's not one of the things that people are necessarily talking about. They kind of have a business and it does well. It doesn't necessarily, they're not necessarily punching above their weight. The French and particularly Canal Plus are often called the HBO of Europe, or certainly the HBO of France, because they come up with those sort of high-end, high-drama, those types of shows. They just picked up, it was in fact a British show, but with Maggie Gyllenhaal, The Honourable Woman, which is a sort of political thriller. So yeah, there's an element of, because they just sort of tick along and they do well, and the same for Holland. They've got this creative powerhouse. You've got John de Mol, who's still making TV shows out there, so he coming on the back of Big Brother. So there was a format this year that sounded remarkably similar to Big Brother. It's called Utopia. The difference is, instead of being in a house, they're essentially in a sort of compound in the middle of nowhere, and you've got 20 people, but it takes a year. So rather than a month or 6 weeks where they live together, creating their own community.
There's a sort of Christiana element to this. Okay.
Geen verwarming, geen sanitair, geen wetten en geen regels. Want Utopia, dat maak je zelf. Durf jij het aan? Ga dan naar utopiatv.nl.
And that's an interesting thing, the sort of personalities, the Basil Jets and the Jean de Mols of the world. Who are the new generation? I mean, because these guys are still seem to put their name to some big concepts. In fact, in the magazine this month, the conversation is between Michael Dobbs, the creator of the original House of Cards in the UK, and Adam Price, who's mm-hmm. the creator of Borgen in Denmark. And they're working on a a thing for BBC TV, which is quite interesting. It was great to hear those two people sort of sparking off each other. But I wonder where that sort of next generation, all these guys are sort of, Adam Price probably is the youngest guy and he's in his sort of 40s. Yeah. It shouldn't be an old man's game, should it? I suppose experience counts for quite a lot.
Yeah, it's interesting you say that because, you know, people are still talking about John de Mol and Michael Dobbs is still involved in some of these projects. So yeah, where does the next generation of talent? A lot of it's coming out of film. I think that's one of the interesting things. You've got a lot of film talent, we've said this before, that are moving into TV. Where are the next Adam Prices? At the moment, they're all kind of, they've had a hit. They've had one show. I know we talked about the Israeli diamond dealer in last month's magazine. So it's sort of seeing if they can replicate that, because the likes of de Mol and Bazalgette just didn't make their name on one hit. So we're sort of in that next phase where hopefully over the next year or two, some of these people will get a bit of a track record so they can actually become the next big thing.
And in terms of distribution, this is another sort of leitmotif, Peter, of our chats when you've come back from Cannes or there's something hot. Netflix are obviously, I suppose, changing the way people watch and changing the way people write drama. Mm-hmm. Now, was this a discussion at Cannes this week, or was it a little bit more about traditional networks commissioning slightly more traditional writing?
No, Netflix and particularly this time Amazon, because they've just rebranded in a lot of territories and are putting a serious amount of cash into doing a relatively same thing in terms of creating content for the web, but also in the way you watch it, putting it all up in line at one time. One interesting conversation I had where someone said to me, you know, what will end up happening in the future perhaps is we'll just create a 12-hour movie and we'll cut it up however we like. That could be in 5-minute spots or that could be in hour-long episodes. So I think the difference, and I think the TV producers and the creators of these shows are less bothered about whether that's an hour for TV or an hour half movie or a 30-minute serial. They're just sort of more interested in this is how long the story's going to take. You deal with the rest.
And there's a thing, I guess there's people, as I say, those two writers, Michael Dobbs and Adam Price, that I spoke to, they've sort of said that it's really nice. There's a lack of constriction. You don't have to be writing to the rhythm of an hour in British TV or an hour in American TV, even more under the cloche of the commercial breaks, where you have to kind of find a crescendo or a cliffhanger after every 15 minutes of drama, or maybe even 7 minutes of drama, to lock your audience in so they don't go away after the commercial break. So it's giving a lot of people said this is giving freedom to writers. They can write the story they want and you can stick in the advertising in front of it or behind it.
Well, the perfect example of that, and on a very similar political note, was Bo Willimon, who's the guy who wrote the American version of House of Cards. Mm. And he, when he approached it, he was a playwright. He came out of what was the play that became Ides of March. And he was very much, he didn't ever write for TV before. He'd never done that. So he didn't really know those breaks. And when he pitched this, he didn't put them in. But because it didn't matter if an episode of House of Cards was 42 minutes long or 53, it didn't matter. It depended on you ended it when his story was ending. And I think that's something that's definitely changing. I think the writers and, you know, especially people that are coming out of the web, whether there was a couple of girls from a show called Broad City, which is this a US comedy for Comedy Central.
Didn't you bring us here to tell us something?
What do you mean?
Isn't there something you want to share with us?
No, we just brought, you guys have never met, we wanted to have brunch with our moms.
I would think, we think that you brought us here because you wanted to tell us that you were lesbians.
What?
No, that is not
on the agenda today.
Are you serious?
We
right
love men and date so many.
They came out of just creating their own stuff for the internet. So they would post up a 30-second clip or they'd post up a 7-minute episode. And then Comedy Central turned that into a traditional half an hour. But it wasn't their job to necessarily put that in. The Comedy Central then had to look at how we do this. And I think that's a bit more freedom for the writers and the producers to be a bit more entertaining and a bit more experimental in terms of how they do that.
If you had to buy, if you're in charge of your sort of fantasy Peter White network, PW1. I'm tuning to PW1, Pete. What's on tonight?
Let's do one from drama and one from formats.
Okay.
50 Cent was in town to shop The Power, which is his version of The Wire.
We open up a nightclub to clean the money.
What if it can be more than that, though, man?
You mean we call it JIT? Live happily ever after?
On formats, Boom, which is a game show whereby it's come from Israel out of the same company that makes Rising Star, which I know we've talked about before. But it's a game show whereby there's a ticking bomb and the contestants have to answer all the questions before it blows up. And it felt very much like a ticking bomb.
Right.
And that gives an element of danger. And I just thought that was quite an interesting tick on the sort of game show genre.
That was Peter White, senior international reporter for Broadcast Magazine and familiar voice to the show, reflecting on this year's MIP TV. For those just joining us, you're listening to Culture with me, Robert Bound. To Stockholm now, where you might be interested to learn that the city's art scene is attracting more interest than it has in years. This year's Stockholm Art Week and Market Art Fair, while small compared to some of their European neighbours, drew record numbers of both visitors and galleries when they took place earlier this month. But while affluent Swedes are happy to view art, they often shy away from actually buying it, preferring to spend their money on refurbing their houses instead. So young art dealers in the city are looking for new ways to find an audience that's actually willing to invest in art. Our woman in Stockholm, Elna Nikkanen Andersson, has the story.
When people think of European art, they tend to think about Paris, London, or perhaps Berlin. But over the last decade, a new player has emerged. After a period of slumber, the Nordic art scene has woken up, and at its helm is Stockholm. At Liljevalchs, a city-owned art museum, champagne is on ice and gallerists are busy explaining the qualities of varied artwork to a steady stream of men and women dressed in black. This is the opening night for the annual Market Art Fair, the most important fair of its kind in the Nordic countries. For 6 days, the fair and Stockholm Art Week have transformed restaurants, hotels and galleries throughout the city, allowing Stockholmers to see work by international heavyweights as well as Swedish stars. Joanna Sundström, one of the organizers, says that the number of visitors has been increasing for several years now.
That shows an interest of the fair. And we can also see, if we see it international, we can see that we have more and more fairs worldwide. And the importance of the fair has grown because it's there you meet the international people. And art is about networking and personal relationships.
Some people believe the Swedish art scene is close to reaching the same kind of vitality it had in the 1960s. Back then, Stockholm's newly opened Museum of Modern Art became the center of an internationally significant art scene, showing works by artists like Robert Rauschenberg and Jasper Johns even before they became names in the US. But over the decades that followed, international interest faded and the art institutions lost their momentum. Things started to change when private art initiatives appeared, says David Neumann, director of the privately owned Magazine 3 Art Museum.
We were brought up knowing that the state would take care of school, healthcare, and education and culture. So when we started Magazine 3 in 1987, it was looked upon quite strangely and some suspicious thoughts, really. The fact that isn't it enough that the state provides the institutions and the culture? And I would say within the last 10 years, we have seen somewhat of a contained explosion when it comes to private initiative. So now in the Stockholm area, we are at least a half a dozen other private institutions. And then most of them, I would say almost all of them, are doing really great work. And they also put a pressure on the more traditional and older institutions that they really have to reinvent themselves.
One of the new faces in town is Paul McCabe, a South African art dealer and consultant who relocated to Stockholm from New York just over a year ago. Thanks to his combined gallery and office space, Stockholmers now have easy access to work from international stars like Damien Hirst and Richard Prince. McCabe sees many advantages in working from Stockholm.
You know, when you've been consulting all these years, you're always kind of moving one thing from one place to the other, technically. And yes, you get to live around great art, and you're always seeing great art. But there's something special about kind of making a decision on a show and then pulling it together, creating the dialogue with the pieces, and then engaging with other people and seeing how they feel about it. there's not that many people showing kind of the caliber of Richard Prince and Peter Doig and Buetti, Hearst. There's not that many people showing that, except for the great institutions, you know, like Magazine 3 and things like that. So I guess it's new in the fact that it's a gallery sort of dedicated to bringing that sort of work.
But while Stockholmers now visit gallery and museum openings with gusto, the step from looking at a piece with a glass of wine in hand to actually agreeing to buy it at the back office is still long. The interest hasn't always created the business gallerists need to pay their bills. While Swedes are happy to spend thousands of euros in redecorating their kitchens and bathrooms, most still have framed posters on their walls, says Johanna Sundström.
I think in Sweden we are very concerned on our homes. We spend lots of money on renovating our apartments and buying the right furniture and have the wine cooler and everything right. But when it comes to art, it's more difficult to know what you like and how to buy it. It is quite difficult for some of the galleries because you need to be so focused on what you do and you need to be present worldwide, international affairs, and at the same time you need to be present at your gallery. So it's a hard work, yeah.
The shortcomings of the traditional gallery model have forced young people to find new ways to reach their public. Jonas Klerup's gallery was hailed as one of the most exciting in the city. While the media loved his artists, he didn't manage to make enough money on the gallery to keep going. Now he's collaborating with Sweden's leading auction house, Bukowskis.
And this is the third stop on the exhibition.
During Art Week, Klerup curated the internationally acclaimed show, The Art of Not Making, featuring works by Gavin Turk, Mike Kelly and Angela de la Cruz, among others.
It's a logical way. For me, it's a good collaboration because I can't reach the same kind of buyers that Bukowskis can reach because they have a stronger name, they have a longer background of working with this kind of thing. So if I would produce it in my own gallery, it would be difficult to get, you know, we have pieces by Gavin Turk for 500,000 kroners, which is difficult for my kind of generation buyers to start buying. But Bukowskis can have the power to kind of to bring in those collectors. It's a very interesting time right now because everyone's trying to find those new ways because having a gallery space is very expensive. If you want to take out the salary and you have staff maybe, you need to push a lot of sales. So a lot of us have been looking at different way to operate, like, you know, maybe do kind of this kind of pop-up thing. Maybe you have shows, maybe you don't need a proper space. Maybe you just need this office somewhere and then you can have your shows taken somewhere else. And that we've seen in Stockholm a lot.
His mission, he says, is to make art more approachable and make people understand the satisfaction in buying a piece of art, something that's not only an investment, but an object that will bring you joy for years to come. If he succeeds, those perfect Swedish kitchens might soon be just a little less perfect, but with a piece of art on the wall instead. For Monocle in Stockholm, I'm Elna Nykänen-Andersson.
Thanks very much, Elna. You are tuned into Culture with me, Robert Bound. From one art event to another coming up next, we're off to evaluate Sydney's Biennale.
The Globalist provides insight and analysis of the key news and business stories in Europe and the Middle East. Informed, engaging and authoritative, it's a 60-minute bulletin of news, features and opinion. Two presenters in London are joined by guests in our studio and all around the world, including Monocle's editors and friends in our Hong Kong and Tokyo bureau. The Globalist also features an extended daily newspaper review with a special guest here in Midori House. And of course, we round up the business headlines with an expert analyst in a key city. All that and more every weekday at 6 a.m. London time on The Globalist.
Welcome back to Culture with me, Robert Bounds. We're from Sweden, we're now headed to Australia. The 19th Biennale of Sydney was in the public's mind long before it started a few weeks ago, but unfortunately not for all the right reasons. A well-publicised controversy surrounding sponsor Transfield's involvement in offshore detention centres took over the discussions about what was happening in the Biennale itself. And this year's lineup is far-reaching, covering multiple venues dominated by video art and surrealist highlights. But is it any good? Does this year's theme work? We dispatched reporter Zoe Ferguson to take the pulse of this year's event and check out the singing mutant, of course.
Norwegian artist Tori Vrones is standing in the vast space that is Cockatoo Island's Turbine Hall. In her performance, Stone and Singer, she's dressed as a hunchback, wearing a mask whose doe eyes stare unblinkingly at the audience. As she sings into her tail, its sound is amplified from the pendulum rock which swings above her. It's a surreal performance, otherworldly, and as Tori explains, powerful in sound.
I have like a new face on, so I actually don't see so much. I just really like to kind of close some of the senses, and then some other senses are just like more volumized in a way. You read so much personality into the face, and I just like to rearrange it in a way and let the voice have more space and the sound itself.
Tori's performance art is one of the standout pieces from the 19th Biennale of Sydney, which is scattered around the city. Taking residence on Cockatoo Island, the Art Gallery of New South Wales, Carriage Works, and the Museum of Contemporary Art, the MCA, as art critic Andrew Frost explains.
The Sydney Biennale is the third longest running Biennale in the world. It tends to be a selection of international artists mixed with a selection of artists from the host country. In Australia's case, there's quite a few in this latest iteration of the event, although that's not always been the case.
The 19th edition of the Biennale of Sydney is entitled You Imagine What You Desire, a title some call ambiguous, but one which artistic director Julianne Engberg wanted to be open to interpretation.
In particular, I wanted to bring visual art back into a kind of hyper-visuality. I wanted to connect to some of the things that I feel are still very potent within the delivery of visual art. So for instance, surrealism, poetry, metaphor, the kind of languages of art that I feel perhaps we've somewhat overlooked during the postmodern period. So I wanted some kind of encapsulating statement that might activate people's thoughts.
But Andrew Frost wasn't so convinced.
There were parts of this Biennale that made sense to me. There were individual works that appealed to me, but it felt incoherent as an overall statement, and I'm not even sure what was intended by the idea of, you know, you imagine what you desire, what those key words were supposed to mean. I think the Biennale suffered from lack of focus. I didn't really understand what it was supposed to be, but having said that, you know, if you can walk away from an exhibition like this and maybe have half a dozen works that you really liked, then it's probably a success on some level.
There are a lot of works to see. On Cockatoo Island, Melbourne artist Callum Morton plunges participants through a stone passageway whose facade looks like the search engine Google, and there are plenty of video installations. Visiting Carriage Works, what Juliana calls her cinematic space, you're met with more video. Weaving in and out of black rooms, one room takes us back to the 1930s, as Juliana explains.
The fantastic work of Matthias Polender, the Austrian artist, for instance, who has made a little bubble of Hollywood musical, which might seem trifling to many, but the amount of labour, skill, technical aspect that lives within that 3.5 minutes is simply awesome to contemplate.
Still on level one at the MCA, we're now standing in a room whose floor is awash with Scottish artist Jim Lambie's vibrant coloured lines zigzagging around. Juliana, tell me about this installation.
And if you look at it long enough, it will actually start to oscillate because of the way in which the stripes have been put down and the different colour combinations and the way in which they ziggurat around some of the architectural details, the columns, the corners, all the irregular bits of this space. And of course, what's fabulous, as you can just see over there, that little kid scooting along the lines, people use it as a kind of interactive mapping of space.
They've given over an entire room, an entire section of the MCA to this piece, and it's essentially striped floors and some sculptures which have been located within the room. And by sculptures, I mean, I'm using that term very generously. One is a selection of sunglasses that have been strung on a string that are hanging in the room. And to say I was underwhelmed by that experience is just a vast understatement in itself. It was annoying in a way that was almost unique. I don't know what it was, and I don't really care.
Before the art conjecture, however, this year's Biennale was subject to a spate of controversy and boycotting regarding its sponsorship. Sponsor Transfield Holdings had recently signed contracts with the Australian government to operate the Manus Island and Nauru detention centres, a move that some of the Biennale's 90 artists weren't happy about. After much debate, Transfield pulled its sponsorship, leaving the Biennale a hole in its funding. Being an international artist, Tori Vranes had to fully comprehend the controversy, but she felt that if she were to boycott the Biennale, she would lose her opportunity to speak about the issue. And strangely enough, her troll character symbolized the conflict at the time.
I think it's just this constant anxiety or like fear, at the same time strength of just standing in it, even though there's something threatens you. Like even the political situation, you just have to stand there and face it and have a voice in it and use the voice.
But despite the politics, the dedication of travelling to all the venues and deciding whether a room's zigzagged flooring makes you feel anything, overall, the 19th Biennale of Sydney is a celebration of creativity and expression. But to some, an experience that lacked cohesion, leaving the punter to question what it really is they imagine they desire. For Monocle in Sydney, I'm Zoe Ferguson.
So there you have it. If you're in Sydney and fancy checking out this year's Biennale for yourself, it's on until the 9th of June. Still to come in part two, more haunting live tracks from Novo Amor. And 40 years after Pinochet assumed power in Chile, we'll explore the new wave of political theatre hitting Santiago. And we'll talk music with Sean Kuti, son of Afrobeat pioneer Fela Kuti. Plenty more to enjoy all here on Culture with me, Robert Bound, on Monocle 24. So before we hear from the playwright setting Chile's theatre scene on fire, we'll take a little time out to hear more of this week's Midori House session. Here's Novo Amor, and that is Ali Lacey with Cranes.
Is this a home that you have built for me? Hold your throne till love is all I need. Have you grown? Have you sold out all our dreams? I'm lost in you. I'm nothing new. I'm nothing new. I'm nothing new. But you still bear a trace. I hold on to the lines I should erase. And so you grew, so you tore yourself away. I'm lost in you, and I'm nothing new. I'm nothing new.
Novo Amor, also known as Ali Lacey, thank you very much for that session. What are the adjectives that people usually use when they first hear your music?
Quaint, dreamy, assuming they're listening to the recordings anyway.
I would have gone straight for haunting.
Yeah, actually that one does come up a lot, yeah.
It was totally haunting. It was a very delicate and fragile sound here. Tell us a bit about your background and how you got into making music.
Well, basically I've been into music since I was probably about 13 when I got my first like Fender Squire. and like a drum kit as well, and just played in bands with my brother and friends while I was in high school and all that. And like, my dad's a keen musician, so there's like always instruments around the house and stuff like that. Basically, I got really into film scoring when I was in college and like learned loads of music theory because of that and kind of what it means to make like good pieces of music. And from that, I kind of wanted to actually write songs. And then that's where the whole Novo Amore thing came from eventually. Kind of actually sat down and started doing it properly, doing songwriting.
And so you've been picked up by a Norwegian label from yes. Bergen called Brilliance. Do people say that there's something going on there between you and the music and, you know, what people would sort of call the Scandinavian melancholy?
Yeah, I mean, people have said it to me a lot. Like before I kind of hooked up with Brilliance, like my music's very Scandinavian and stuff. Like, works well with the mountains and like the cold and all that kind of scenery. But yeah, it's nothing really to do with it. I just wanted to get a label kind of outside of the UK, and I thought that Norway was a kind of good place going, and I'd heard of Brilliance and I heard they were doing good work.
Why was that? Why did you not want to be based in the UK?
It's not that I really didn't want to. It's just that I was asking a couple of people in the UK and it just wasn't really sounding very promising, and it's just appealed to me to branch out a bit more.
And so you're two EPs in, there's a lot of interest and there's a lot of interest in people booking you live. Today it's just been a very stripped down session, but what's your vision of your live setup?
Well, on the recording there's like vocals layered like five times, like loads of guitars, percussion and everything. So ideally, if I could get a full band playing this stuff, I'd have to have at least another guitarist, some kind of ambient keyboardist, a percussionist, a bassist, and someone who at least could do some harmonies. But I'm quite happy doing it quite small and stripped back to maybe two or three people.
That was Novo Amore speaking to Paul Noble, and you heard Cranes before that. Novo Amore's new EP, Woodgate NY, is out next week. You're listening to Culture with me, Robert Bounds. There's a brave new world of theatre in Chile. The starting gun for this year's race to sharp, incisive, original and gripping drama is what's mostly thought of as a pretty ugly anniversary. It's 40 years since General Augusto Pinochet stole power in the country. Working with London's Royal Court Theatre, five new young playwrights have addressed the politics and reality of 17 years of cultural strangulation under Pinochet's rule. The current president, Michelle Bachelet, has promised an emphasis on reducing inequality through culture, so is it a revolution on the stages of Santiago? Reporter Dorothy Fever went to meet the new generation rewriting Chile's cultural landscape.
Michelle Bachelet striding up the red carpet into Chile's Congress is nothing short of theatre. She's welcomed on stage by Leader of the Senate, Isabel Allende, who places the red, white and blue presidential sash on Bachelet's shoulder. Both women had lost their fathers in 1973, and their rise to power underlines the fact that Chile's still coming to terms with the painful years of the dictatorship.
The dictatorship was a huge cultural vacuum. There was no official theatre. But now, you could say, we're going through a boom.
Florencia Martinez Echeverria is one of 12 writers who took part in an exchange with the Royal Court Theatre in London to mark the 40th anniversary of Pinochet's coup. So was Juan Andrea Rivera.
When the Royal Court staff came to Chile, they were like surprised by it because the first task that we were supposed to do was this list of important subjects that were happening in Chile, and we wrote so many of them. Of course, there was dictatorship, there was like the Mapuche conflict, capitalism, there was an important subject.
In the last few years, Santiago's skyline has been dominated by sparkling skyscrapers. They form the so-called San Hatton District, which announces Chile as one of the wealthiest countries in Latin America. Whether or not there's a trickle-down effect is something that Camila Lebert questions.
Everybody does everything for free, and that is just very difficult to get out of. A big, big plus on the Santiago scene, from what I know of other cities, is that there are a lot of available spaces.
So Bosco Cayo Alvarez trained as a psychologist before writing plays.
But it's not just about theatre spaces. The problem is financing plays. You only get one chance a year to apply for funding, and doing it independently is extremely difficult.
Since theatres don't finance plays, the annual competition for government funding, known as Fondart, is a fierce scramble. The theatre world is also a hustle, and not one of the Royal Court group can afford to call themselves solely a playwright. Juan, for example, is a set designer, and he directs his own theatre production company.
Many of the writers are actors, and they act a lot, and they teach, and they sew, I don't know, many things.
We have to include producing, because we're all producing. Anybody who has an idea has to basically make it happen.
The incoming government seems keen to get things happening. New Culture Minister Claudia Baratini has twice the budget and promises to open a 2,000-seat theatre in GAM, which is Santiago's flagship art centre.
Which is very symbolic also because it was inaugurated during Allende's government. And then because Pinochet had bombarded La Moneda, he took his offices there and he renamed it. And there was a fire.
There was a fire.
And there was this huge building which was just very...
burned.
very creepy.
Yeah.
And then Batelet remodeled it as, again, Centro Cultural Gabriela Mistral.
If GAM is some kind of phoenix from the flames, what I wondered was whether the writers could also trace a line in theatre going back to the 70s.
In the dictatorship, there was sort of a blackout, culturally speaking, but there was very interesting and important directors, writers, too, that worked in that period underground. I think that influenced all of the playwriting since then.
Bosco had taken time out of rehearsals to talk to me. He's just adapted Leftraru about a heroic Mapuche general, and it's soon to open at that very same Catholic university.
There were three stages of theatre. First, it was classical and non-political. Then, under Pinochet, it was defined by opposition. It was a form of resistance. And now we're in stage three, rehabilitation. Talking about a painful past is part of the process of recreating our national identity.
Emilia Noguera is from an acting family, and she acts and writes for television as well as for theatre.
Before, if you wanted to be involved in the art world and you weren't opposing the dictatorship, you were criticised. But now we can talk about problems without being judged by our peers.
Camilla, on the other hand, detects a sort of worrying tendency in this third stage of theatre.
The big thing about the dictatorship was the metaphors and the way they had, the Ictus theatre had transformed the language in order to talk about things without talking about them. And I think sometimes we're getting a little too literal. And I also think that's an influence of television. I don't know, my play, Chan, is from a TV show. Every time they have a big
statement or when they say something harsh.
Yeah.
They go with this sound effect which is chan, 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 chan.
So that has become part of, our language, and that's in the play, whatever. But
Claudia Hidalgo's play, That Thing I Never Shared With You, is about a dark family secret. And she says it's absolutely political.
My play deals with consequences of the past. Whether we're children of people from the left or the military government, we're all affected by what they've done.
What might Chilean drama look like in the future, on the 50th anniversary of Pinochet's coup? Bosco, for one, is optimistic.
I hope we'll have institutions to protect culture in Chile in a way that simply doesn't exist now.
One of the qualities of Chilean writing is its confrontational political bent, which it would be a shame to lose. But although we're rushing to be a developed European-style nation, nothing works under the surface, and that is a great source of drama.
For Monocle in Santiago de Chile, I'm Dorothy Fever.
Thanks, Dorothy, and you are tuned in to Culture with me, Robert Bounds, on Monocle 24, a journey through African music with none other than Sean Kuti is coming up next.
A new generation of stationary entrepreneurs are reviving the art of letter writing. Monocle Films travels to Prague, Vancouver, and London to visit three stationary shops who share a love of paper.
I was always fascinated by the fact how many different forms the simple piece of paper can have. I like the space that opens up when you unfold a simple piece of paper or when you open the notebook, and no email can ever replace the feeling when you open your mailbox and you find the letter there.
A celluloid celebration of old school stationery shops, now playing in the film's menu on monocle.com.
Well, Welcome back to Culture with me, Robert Bounds. As the youngest son of legendary Nigerian Afrobeat pioneer Fela Kuti, Sean Kuti was born to be a musician. He performed alongside his father from a young age and took over Egypt 80 following Fela's death in 1997. Though he doesn't have his own political party as his father did, he heartily endorses his politics and wants to effect change through his music, a fusion of big band jazz, funk and traditional African sounds. Sean Kuti in Egypt 80 has just released their third album, A Long Way to the Beginning, and Monocle's Georgina Godwin caught up with him during a recent visit to London.
What I did in my new record, I had M1 from Dead Prez, you know, even if he's African American, he's traced back his African roots. Rather call him Mr. Mutulu. Blitz the Ambassador, who is from Ghana. And I also work with Nneka. And back in my country, I've done a song with a reggae raga artist called Shanks. For me, the content of new African music is a bit weak. I don't mean to sound harsh, but you know, I hear their music, I don't see how it is relevant to anything that is happening in Africa. Champagne, life, fast cars and designer clothes, come on. Only 2 or 3% of Africans even see that stuff. I'm not interested. As I said, you know, I'm not a musical vendor. If I believe in your music and what you stand for, then I want to work with you.
Tell me about your new album.
You mean the greatest album ever made? Well, A Long Way to the Beginning for me is it's my third album, my best album so far, for sure. It represents me completely, where I am now as a musician and where I am also as a human being personally, where my mind is at, you know, so yeah. I really do believe in what the album stands for also in general. And the title, for me, you know, we Afrobeat today, where it is in the world. You know, Fela started Afrobeat, but I believe that this is the beginning for Afrobeat. A lot of people are interested in Afrobeat music. You know, with the play, now the movie, the documentary in Sundance, you know, all the samplings and all the bands, you know. And people also wanting that sound. You know, everybody tired of this Miley Cyrus, Rihanna, all them. I think most people tired of that, I said maybe young people. And I think Afrobeat, this is the beginning, you know. We could give people that sound, we could give people that, you know, that feeling they had of music in the 70s, where music spoke for the people, in the 60s. When music was at the forefront of the civil rights movement, you know, and civil liberation and women, feminist movement, Nina Simone, you know, writers like Maya Angelou and Billie Holiday, you know, and Fitzgerald, you know, I mean, how many women musicians today are on this level? I mean, they are not even on that level as musicians, you know, the music level of musicianship, they are not even on that level, you know, but even in the intellectual level, coming down to talk to women and making them feel intellectually equal to the man, not sexually equal.
The black woman.
Do you think that you are feeling more strongly about this now because you've had a baby?
Yes, I am. More strongly about the economy, more strongly about the perception of black women and where we're going. And I'm completely fed up as well. I mean, my grandmother was in the struggle. I never met her. She was killed. My father was in the struggle with my mother. I lost them both very early because of the struggle. And now I have a daughter. And I'm involved in the struggle too. So when what's going on? Like, when are Nigerians, when are Africans going to wake up? When are we going to realize that it's time that, you know, I mean, people are giving their lives for this shit. And people just continue to toe the line like donkeys. But at the same time, you have to realize that Africans are attacked not only on an economic level, they are attacked on a mental level too, with so much propaganda on TV, so much the Christianity, the Islam, selling them the false hope of being docile and going to heaven after they die. You understand?
You know. You could pack up and move away. You could be in Los Angeles. You don't have to put up with all of this, but you choose to.
Who's going to do it? That's exactly what I'm saying. Like, you know, who's going to change it if we all decide to move to, you know, Europe and America? And my daughter was born in France. I was never given the option. I think that's the only mistake my parents have made. Maybe if they'd given me a British passport, maybe I'll be in Britain today. You know, but my dad decided I was going to be born in Nigeria, you know. But I don't think, because Femi has a British passport. He was born in England, you know, but he stays back home. I think it's just because we believe that we have to be home. We have to be where we want. We have to be the change we want to see. I mean, how can we say we want to change Africa and we are staying in Europe? You never go through what your brothers and sisters are going through. You know, if you don't experience police brutality, how can you speak about it? You know, if the Nigerian police has not slapped you in the face once or twice, how do you know that what's going on? You just be a laptop gangster. You know, it's good to be there, experience. I'm not saying people that are fighting for Africa from the diaspora are not doing, you know, to each his own. Maybe I've been a bit too critical of myself just now by saying laptop gangster. To each his own, you know. I think all I can ask from Africans, anywhere they are, is to be committed as much as they can.
Where music and politics collide, that was Sean Couty speaking to Georgina Godwin. Sean's playing various dates around the world this year with Egypt 80, and his new album, A Long Way to the Beginning, produced by Robert Glasper, is out now in Europe and will be available in the US from the 24th of May. And that's just about all we have time for this week. Next time, we'll be exploring the theme of new beginnings, reimagining the album, mapping the unmapped, the new frontiers of Spanish comedy, and much more. All will be revealed. You've been listening to Culture with me, Robert Bound. My producer is Katie Bilbao, the wicked stepmother to the blossoming Cinderella that is Holly Fisher. Time for one final song this week from their Midori House session. This is Novo Amor with Flay. Thanks for tuning in.
My eyes have been underwater. Rested in the rain, and I let go of all that I want to. Thoughts of shame.
Say that you don't know.